you know, there's no, you choose a path and you have to stay on that path. Like, I think those paths are very windy and sometimes even have a U-turn, right? Because I think there can be times in your life where maybe I passed up a right decision, you know, because it just wasn't the right time, or there was something else unrelated that just wasn't going to fall into place. So, you know, I think you have to give yourself a little bit of a break. Sometimes things will work out and be the right time, and sometimes they just won't.
Welcome to the Seize the Yay podcast. Busy and happy are not the same thing. We too rarely question what makes the heart sing. We work, then we rest, but rarely we play, and often don't realize there's more than one way. So this is a platform to hear and explore the stories of those who found lives they adore. The good, bad and ugly, the best and worst day, will bear all the facets of seizing your yay. I'm Sarah Davidson, or Spoonful of Sarah, a lawyer turned funtrepreneur who swapped the suits and heels to co-found Matcha Maiden and Matcha Milk Bar. Seize the Yay is a series of conversations on finding a life you love and exploring the self-doubt, challenge, joy and fulfillment along the way. Hello, lovely neighborhood, and happy International Women's Day. It is one of my favorite days of the year. Well, of course, us gals deserve to be celebrated every single day. We shouldn't need just one day marked in the calendar. I still love the way that having an actual day set aside encourages really amazing conversations, gatherings and events, public displays of support for each other, for each other's work, for each other's businesses, for everything. Even just telling someone in your close circle that you love and appreciate having them in your life. I'll never say no to an excuse to do more of that. And this year it's meant even more to me as I kind of tippy-toe right on the doorstep of motherhood in this last couple of weeks. Oh my God, that is so wild that there's only a couple of weeks to go. I've always been a raging feminist, but I've never had more appreciation for the strength and resilience of women than experiencing pregnancy. And that's before our little baby has even arrived. We are just so fierce and powerful and pure magic, really, and even more so when we unite together. So happy International Women's Day to you all. Happy International Women's Week. I know the celebrations are extending throughout the week, the month. Again, it should be the year, but also to all the allies who love and support the women in their lives, because having male feminists around is equally as important to unite for the cause of pushing women further along. You might have seen we've already dropped a Chaotic Years of Our Lives episode just a couple of days ago that we ended up spontaneously live streaming, but I'm following that up today with a special guest for the occasion, patching in from stateside. As you know, Nick and I have been lucky to partner with the incredible team at SunPower and have had the most amazing transition to solar energy. And today we have their Chief Legal and Sustainability Officer on the show, Lindsay Weedman. Not only does she have a fascinating, twisting and turning, unpredictable way to yay, as you know we love, from a Bachelor of Science originally, to then a postgrad in law, to then project finance in a corporate law firm before moving into her current role, which is completely different. She also has some fascinating insights on life as a woman in the traditionally male-dominated energy sector, which I'm sure many of you will identify with, working in male-dominated environments and forging away as a woman. I'll let her tell you the rest herself, but I hope you enjoy as much as I did. Lindsay, welcome to Seize the Yay.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah, for having me. It's a real treat.
Oh, thank you so much for joining. And we have already proven that we love technology. We are so agile. It's taken us a few false starts, but where there's a will, there's a way. We will seize the yay today.
It's the way it always is, right?
Absolutely. Well, we are so incredibly lucky to have you here, and there's so much material to cover today. But as our listeners know, and I mentioned to you quickly, I love to, before getting into anything really juicy, well, I guess this is the juicy part, but before we get to sort of sustainability and solar power and all the million questions that I have for you to draw on your expertise, I love to go back to the very beginning and work out how you even got to this position of expertise and what you were like as a child. And I think the pathway is the bit we skate over so often, mm-hmm. but people who are maybe earlier on in their journey or don't know where they want to end up, hearing how you got there is often kind of the most inspiring and exciting thing. So can you take us back to maybe your childhood self even? Like, you're now a chief legal and sustainability officer, but I'm sure you didn't wake up at five and go, I want to be a chief legal and sustainability officer when I grow up.
Definitely
How
not.
How did it all begin?
Definitely not. Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this. And as a child, you know, there are some themes. And I think, you know, to anyone who's kind of early on in their career, and, you know, frankly, those of us who are still in the middle of our careers, right? People can, you know, take different paths at different times. You know, for me personally, there's been a consistency around the planet. When I was a kid, I felt, you know, very concerned about the planet. I don't think I was anxiety ridden, but I was probably thinking about things maybe a little more seriously than I needed to as a young child. you know, I was wondering like how, you know, we love all the animals and, you know, I loved being out in nature and, you know, I just didn't really understand why no one else was concerned about what was happening because you would see things, you know, happening around you. So I did have a bit of, this is really important and it was important to me. And part of it was a very visceral reaction of just loving animals and like, you know, if you'd see one that was like hurt, you'd want to go help it or, you know, you'd see a tree being cut down and it would make me really sad. And so some of that was just, I think, just visceral human. And part of it was also just feeling like there was like a finite resource and, you know, there was not as much thought going into it that I thought it warranted. So I do remember having those feelings very young and they kind of, you know, it wasn't all consuming or anything, but, you know, for example, I was a vegetarian very early. I probably started like around 12, you know, before that. Like, I'm not a vegetarian anymore, to be clear. So I totally jumped off, you know, jumped off that train. But, you know, I was playing with these things and these emotions. So that's been a consistent thing for me through my life. But how that's, you know, kind of shown itself has changed a lot as I've, you know, grown up.
I love that because I think often in hindsight, you can really clearly see the themes and the dots that all connect looking backwards. But at the time, it's often really hard to translate those interests and inclinations into a pathway. Like as a kid, it's so straightforward that I like animals or I'm interested in space or cars or whatever it is. We all have our interests. But then as you sort of get into the education system, it's like, well, what do you do with that? Like, what does that actually mean for your life?
Exactly.
And that's the bit I think we all struggle with. So I love that, you know, looking sort of on paper, your first degree was a Bachelor of Science, which ties into all that. But, you know, at school, how did you translate that interest into something? Did you know that you wanted to go the science path? Did you do sport? Like you were, did you grow up in California, by the way?
I did. I grew up in California. I was born in New York, but a very short until I went back to law school. I was just born there. I grew up in California and science to me, I do have, that's my brain is kind of more wired that way. So science to me was something that I was very interested in. And I think was easier for me than, it's kind of ironic that I went to law school because I'm English. My mother's an English teacher and it was not my favorite subject.
Yeah, I'm like, there's a lot of big jumps.
There's a lot of jumps
that happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of jumps that happen. And I think that's a good, you know, I hope for listeners that that's somewhat reassuring. Like you can explore different parts of your, what draws you and like what your experience is and where your talents lie. I think you know, there's no, you choose a path and you have to stay on that path. Like I think there is, you know, those paths are very windy and sometimes even have a U-turn, right? But yeah, the sciences for me were always very, I just found it very interesting. Like I could not get enough information and, you know, I just loved learning about science. It explained a lot about what was going on around you, you know, and that's how it felt for me. It felt very comfortable to be able to understand why and then the why of the why. You know, I think as I went through university and was teaching and I started realizing that I liked learning about science and I still do, but I was becoming less interested in actually being a scientist, you know, and some of that can be, you know, I think back to like the fact that you're making decisions when you're 20 years old and the things that, you know, some of the reasons I made certain decisions, like in hindsight, you know, but, you know, I think deep down I felt like that wasn't a path for me and at the time. And so I graduated from university having completely focused as a biologist. And that meant, you know, a lot of chemistry and biology. And then graduated and really didn't know what I was going to do.
I think that's so common.
I think it's very common, and I think that's okay. You know, I think it's actually healthy. You know, I mean, there are people that just know what they want to do. You know, you've met those people where they're like, okay, this is like what I want to do.
Yeah.
And they just do it and they're like content and happy. So that's obviously not, that's a great thing as well. But I think it's like, okay to really question and explore and see what else is out there if what you're currently doing isn't really working for you. So.
And I think there's so much societal pressure as well on like, don't waste time and you've got to figure it out now. And if you don't know where you want to end up, then how do you know that your momentum right now is in the right direction and all that kind of stress about finding your passion? And I think the reason I labor the earlier parts of people's lives, even if it's not sort of where they ended up, is to remind our listeners that like at any time, it could be at the university years, sometimes it's like well into a career that people just go, this is either was never for me or is no longer for me or has turned into something that's no longer for me. And it's totally fine to sort of change from, you know, I'm going to be a biologist to I'm going to move to the other side of a country and be in a law firm, which is like totally the opposite to a science career. So I also think it's probably more common because of the kind of college system in the US. But here, you know, doing postgrad study after you've finished one degree is kind of a big deal. You know, you're a more mature age student. It's sort of got all that pressure of, well, I've already paid for one degree and I'm doing something else. You know, how did you decide 2 years later to do a law degree?
You know, there's, like I said, English wasn't my, you know, favorite subject. And, you know, I tend to avoid confrontation. So some of it probably was a little confusing to people that know me. But no, I mean, there's a lot of ways to practice law, as you know very well.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't expect that you would go into project finance, but amazing. Yeah. Tell us how you got there.
Yeah. So I didn't know what I wanted to do when I graduated. I was pretty sure that I didn't want to be a doctor, even though I had done all the prerequisites for that. As I mentioned, I wasn't really that sure about being a scientist. And when you go into grad school for science, I mean, it's very targeted. Like, here's what you want to do. Here's the, you know, and it's a very small thing that you're working on and very committed, right? And I was at that mm-hmm. place at all. And law, the beauty of law, I think, and I really don't regret going at all. Like I'm very grateful that I took this path, is that it, law school trains you to think a certain way. And it's a very useful way to think. It's a very analytical way to think. And the thing that I loved about it, even applying to law school, is a lot of it's just about solving problems. And that's what I find really interesting and rewarding. And you can case in point for you, you can graduate with law and do a lot of different things. You find lawyers in all parts of society. And so for where I was in my life, it just felt like the right choice because I wasn't ready. I wanted more education to build on to my biology degree. It is scary because here in the US, different than other parts of the world, you know, it is a pretty big loan burden you're taking on as an individual. But, you know, I did think I needed to go to more schooling and I also love school. So I think it was also an easy excuse to stay in school.
How long can I be a student?
I know. How do I make this happen as much as possible? And then I knew I'd graduate and have a lot of options and be, you know, it would be very useful. So that's why I did it. But I, you know, I was still a bit of a leap of faith going into there. And you certainly arrive on the first day of law school, you know, Columbia's got an excellent law school. And, you know, there are those people there that have wanted to be a lawyer since they were talking and, you know, done all of their preparatory work and were very, you know, and then I was probably the other end of the spectrum. But I really treasure those years at Columbia and being in New York City and just kind of opening my mind to a whole new, you know, really high quality education and really, really enriching experiences. So the project finance came about because, you know, in law, you're really divided into two types of practice. There's the disputes practice, which is kind of what you see on TV with, you know, lawyers in courtrooms and which is a very obviously important part of the legal system. But there's also the commercial side of the legal system, which is, you know, supporting business and creating, you know, you can call it contractual law or whatever, you know, but a different practice. And I was drawn to that just from a way of working perspective. And project finance, I came across fairly early. I was taking some classes at the business school and at the international school and really learned about how infrastructure was built. And I was focused, as you probably can ascertain, on renewables.
I was going to say, yeah. What kind of projects did you do?
So I was instantly drawn to renewables, and project finance, like I said, was kind of a way to solve problems to get these renewable projects built. So the pieces kind of came together pretty early for me, which was not like my personality, where I didn't go into every part of the law school and explore every possibility. That came to me pretty early. And so I focused pretty early. And that was something that just kind of played to my, I think, the way my brain works. And like I said, just kind of that analytical, because like project finance really is pulling in all these pieces into making something make sense on paper, and then it gets built, you know? And so you've got, you know, you've got your, all your permitting, you've got all your government, you know, approvals, you got to set up the financing, the technology, like all these things have to come together. And as a lawyer, you're really making sure it all comes together and minimizing the risk. So intellectually, it's also really, really fun.
I think it's so cool that you had this common theme of renewable energy and sustainability and the planet, but you kind of came at it from one angle as a biologist and sort of thought, this is actually not the angle that I am maybe going to take. But then you kind of ended up in all the subsequent chapters, finding different ways to come at the same passion. And I think that's the challenge, is we often think the passion needs to change because like the first try doesn't work out. But it's like, no, the yay, once you've found it, it's rare. A lot of people don't even find it. But once you've got it, it's just experimenting with the different ways you could mold different skill sets or different career paths or different chapters to come at it. And I wouldn't have necessarily thought law would allow you as much at that early to kind of focus on renewables, but amazing that you got to do that. What I think is really interesting is that you were in, you know, a law firm context and got to sort of travel around the States and then into Singapore and had a big chapter there. But one of the sort of themes that emerges in this section of people's lives is when you found something that's really good, how you know when it's time for a new chapter, because you've since moved on, you're no longer at that firm. And it doesn't sound like you didn't like, you know, firm life. I think a lot of people leave because they get into somewhere and they go, oh, it's not for me. It obviously you made it for you. Mm-hmm. So what was that chapter like? And then how did you sort of come to the conclusion that, okay, this has been one manifestation and now I'm going to move on to in-house? Like, how does that happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was one of the people that, you know, I didn't hate firm life. You know, I lucked out. I got into a really good group and the team in San Francisco, and we were doing a lot of renewables. So that helped.
Yeah.
That was good. But, you know, there was so much to learn, and I was just, you know, I was really grateful and found it really rewarding. I did at some point know that wasn't my long-term path. I would describe, and I do this with when I interview people to come join my team, people come moving in, you know, from it private practice into a firm, is, you know, I think private practice and law firms are really great for people that like to be deep experts in particular things, because you're working for so many clients, you are the expert, right? You see all these different ways of doing things, and you've got this broad market view, and you are paid for that expertise and really love that. For me, it was really more about the broader view and the impact. And so after I kind of had learned what I thought I needed to learn, the business model for me was less interesting. And so I kind of knew that, but I was still really happy and but wanted to go abroad and kind of expand my horizons. And so I was able to go to Singapore and work in project finance. And that was great to be Southeast Asia. And there was one project that I was working on, and it was we were working for the IFC, which is, you know, they provide funding to developing nations. And we were advising the Vietnam government on developing a coal plant. And so I was going up to Hanoi, you know, frequently, and it was a bit of an ethical struggle for me, because in one way, you know, coal is a very cheap, fast way to bring a lot of electricity to a country, and certainly, so it's kind of hard to come from the United States and say you shouldn't have coal given, you know, all the progress that was made in the United States. But at the same time, it was challenging for me. And, you know, there was also the way that the funding was set up, you know, a lot of environmental rules didn't need to be followed. So it was definitely gnawing at me. And that was actually the project where I said, okay, I think I'm done. Yeah. I'm going to go find a renewable company to work for. At this point, it's time. And so I moved back to the United States and I immediately started looking and I joined SunPower.
Wow. It's so interesting thinking about when people make big changes like that, especially if it involves moving countries, but when it involves moving, you know, from a structure as a lawyer in a firm into an in-house position, like I think it's easy to tell the story in hindsight, just chronologically. I had this realization, I left, but we often skate over like the self-doubt, the implications for am I successful? I'm going back to the start in something that I've never done before. You're vulnerable because you're applying for positions, you know, all that stuff that you get really comfortable in a certain role. And then suddenly it's like something makes you realize that you're agitating for something else. How did that all work for you? Did you grapple with your identity? I'm not with a big firm anymore. Like I'm starting from scratch. Do you have self-doubt? How do you deal with that dialogue? Do you just risk management of like moving home? Like, you know, all that stuff. Like how does a big pivot for you work in your brain?
It's a great question. And there certainly have been pivots I haven't taken. And you do look back and you say, huh, like I wonder.
Yeah.
So it's not like I've always just taken the right pivot and it's great. But it's a really important question because I think there can be times in your life where maybe I passed up a right decision, you know, because it just wasn't the right time or there was something else unrelated that just wasn't going to fall into place. So, you know, I think everyone and to listeners, you have to give yourself a little bit of a break. You know, sometimes things will work out and be the right time and sometimes they just won't. In this case, for me, you know, I had thought through it enough and I think it had kind of been brewing long enough that it wasn't a sudden thing. It was a little more calculated for me. So I didn't struggle as much with that decision. I was also, you know, I didn't have kids yet. Like, I mean, it's also easier to make some bigger moves when you're just taking care of yourself.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that might be part of it, but you know, no, I think it felt right. And I think in the end, that's for me, that's, you got to listen to your gut, you know, plan enough that if your gut doesn't work out, you've got some other options, but in the end, you know, you kind of do need to trust yourself and make those changes when it feels like it's the right time.
And do you ever get stuck in, like, I think for women in particular, and as we move more into kind of like the energy sector and the challenges for gender diversity and, you know, the landscape, before we get into that, law is similar, I think, in that regard, where women in particular, everyone, but women in particular, do often face institutional inequalities that then lead to, you know, self-doubt and imposter syndrome and do I have to be someone else and manifest different attributes to get ahead and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Did you ever struggle with that either in the law or as you were moving into the sector as an actual like general counsel?
I think about this question a lot because you read studies and, you know, you hear about, you know, women having a harder time in these moments. And I think it's very true. You know, I was very prone to, if I work hard and I just do a really good job and I'm really diligent, someone's going to notice and they're just going to tap me on the shoulder and say, hey, Lindsay, why don't you go do this? And, you know.
Yeah. We have noticed that you are doing very well. You just serve this.
Sat around a room and thought about what you should be doing next, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I do think that's like ingrained. I think it's somewhat, you know, ingrained in. I do think women are more prone to that than men. I think they will just work hard and feel like people should notice and wait for the tap on the shoulder. And the big movements I've had in my career have been when I've just jumped for something and asked for it. That doesn't happen very often. You don't have to do that frequently. But I think, you know, I think those periods were filled with times of working really hard, being really diligent so that you kind of are set up for when you jump for it. People are like, oh yeah, that actually makes sense. But I think you do have to take control of that yourself and just, you know, ask for what you want, I think the worst is people say no. And to be honest, if they say no, then they were never going to give it to you to begin with. So you haven't really lost anything.
Yes. Yeah. You might feel silly for like 20 seconds and then like the moment's passed. It's not as bad as you ever imagine it could
yeah,
be.
Yeah. And probably a lot less worse than if you never asked and you never knew if you would have gotten it, you know? So I do think that that's something that is like something that has to be exercised and like, you know, doesn't come naturally. I think that's harder for women in like a law firm, like you said, or in other industries in the corporate world, because that's how you make those little jumps in your career.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest sort of breakthroughs I had was realizing, firstly, that tap on the shoulder, it's not coming because anyone doesn't want you to have that opportunity. It's just because the decision makers are busy. Like they've got their own stuff going on. So sometimes you just have to be the loudest thing that's drawing their attention to you. It's we're all human. Like I won't necessarily notice what 10 other people around me are doing unless someone is yelling, "I'm doing a good job." And then I'll go, "Yeah, you are." Yeah. But you're not constantly looking for things outside the purview of your own job. Mm-hmm. So I kind of think once I took all the whole like it's a conspiracy, everyone's conspiring against me thing away and was just like, "No, people are just busy."
Yeah.
So if you can just gently draw their attention and put your hand up, people want you to do that most of the time.
They want you to, because they're not, to be honest, they're not thinking about you. Like you said, they're just busy, no. You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, if that thing isn't right, you might jump into their brain more quickly the next time too. So it's like, even if that one thing doesn't work out, you know, like a project you really want to work on and you're like, "I'll do it," you know, and they're like, "Oh, we got it." The next time they may be like, "Oh, actually," you know? So it's also if that one moment doesn't proceed the way you want. I think it's actually just helpful and it, you know, and then you can also learn from it. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, before we move into the big industry change and this kind of sector you've moved into and remain in today, I'd love to just ask your opinion on something that's kind of come up a lot in conversation since I moved into business, actually, which was the cultural difference between the working landscape in the US and Australia. And just following on from that self-doubt imposter syndrome thing, it's so cultural in Australia to face tall poppy syndrome and worry about people judging you for putting yourself out there and to think that self-deprecation is a really good trait that you need to show all the time because we relate to that so much. We kind of bond over just knocking ourselves down a few pegs, mm-hmm. like let alone other people doing it for us. It's really like we're like, "Oh, he's so humble." Like that's a real compliment. And I found in business that worked really well for me to sort of be like, "It was a happy accident. I fumbled into this. I, you know, it was all like just winging it," which is true. But when we moved into the States with our, we had a big tea business, it just didn't land very well. Like Americans were all, and a mass generalization obviously, but it just seemed that the sort of general response to that kind of self-deprecation was, "If you don't have faith in you, like why am I going to take you on? You're already telling me what's not on purpose about why you're here. You're not really setting me up to believe that you could be successful." And I sort of was really confronted by how confident other people pitching would be and how easily it came out of their mouths to say, "I am really proud that we achieved this," even though they should be really proud that they achieved it. I'd be like, "Whoa, that's so forward. Like, God, calm down. You're so confident."
Yeah.
But I had to really get over that because, like, in pitching, you're meant to be putting your best foot forward, and I was putting my worst foot forward and then being confused. Do you find, having started your life in an American workforce, do you notice that?
It's a great question. I was operating in the American workforce doing what you're doing or we're doing in Australia. So, you know, I would say things like, "Well, I'm not really an expert here, but here's what I think," or, you know, just like kind of apologizing before I would speak.
Oh, you do the Australian thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was doing that. So yeah. Maybe I should have just moved to Australia.
Yeah.
Would have been a lot.
You would have gone straight ahead.
That would have been a lot less confusing. You know, for me, it just felt like I wanted to make sure people knew I was self-aware that like I'm not an expert and, yeah. you know, that I had yeah. this like perception of like, but no one wants to hear that. Like you said,
yeah, it's
like,
they really don't.
They don't want to, if you're not an expert, they don't want you to keep talking. You know, it's almost like saying like, "No offense, but," like if you were saying that in the beginning, yeah. like, people just stop listening. So it took me a while to learn that. And I think as I've grown and, you know, forward in my career, I've really tried to cut that back. Comes out every once in a while. I still catch myself every once in a while. So maybe I do have a next career in Australia. I think that's an accurate assessment. And, you know, people aren't shy in the US also about, you know, I fit about half of that. It's fine. Like, I'll just, you know, like overpromise and I'll figure it out. Right. There's a lot of that.
Which is, I think, is so valuable. Like, it really is how you get ahead. And I think we treat like saying you're successful or owning success you have actually had. It's not even like you're making it up. Mm-hmm. It's such a dirty word here. It's like, oh my God, she's got tickets on herself. But it's really refreshing when you're in a room of people who are pitching like the actual amazing things they've done, not boasting, they're just saying it because it's an actual fact. And it really helped change my mindset around like, it's okay to say you did a good job. That's fine.
Yeah. How does that go over in Australia?
I think you do still walk this very fine line of humility and likability, but there's a way to do it that isn't constant self-deprecation. Like, you kind of can come in the middle a little bit more than, oh my God, I know nothing, so don't listen to me. But it's just like, let's meet in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. Good.
So moving into SunPower, Maxeon Solar Technologies, mm-hmm. which is known as SunPower in Australia. I think it's been 10 years now with SunPower for you.
Yeah, I joined, you know, even if you combine the two, it's been 13 going on 14. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So before we get into like what the company is doing and I feel so privileged to be able to work with the company, what is kind of the lay of the land of the sector and the industry? Because a lot of people are getting increasingly enthusiastic about clean energy and being involved as consumers, but I don't think it's something the average person knows much about in terms of how the industry works. What are the challenges in clean energy, not just for people who work in it, but for the world? You know, where are we kind of at the moment?
Yeah, that's a great...
That's a huge question. We need a whole mini series, but like it's some dot points.
Yeah, it's a big question, but it's an interesting one because the industry is so dynamic. And I think that's why I've been in it for so long. It's been almost like five different careers. You know, when I started back in 2010, we were still in the phase of like convincing people that solar made sense, you know, or that it wasn't just for people. You know, back then it was almost like a luxury, like I have a lot of money and I care about the planet, so I'll get a solar system. Or it was just kind of a fringe thing. And climate wasn't that much of a hot topic either back in 2010. So it was really this uphill battle with awareness. And everything was growing very quickly, but it had started off so tiny, you know. So yeah, there's a lot of growth, but it still, in the grand scheme of things, wasn't that significant. And it's just, you know, it's gone through such big changes over the years. And I think, you know, a big part of it really is, I think, the climate just impacting people's day-to-day lives. And, you know, there's just been over this 13 years a real shift, I think, in people's thinking of, oh, this is something that's really impacting me and got to figure it out. So I think at a grand scale, that seems to be what's happening in solar. A big thing, it's if you look at the cost curves of how much cost and has come out of making solar panels, it's quite astronomical. You know, it's pretty unbelievable. And a lot of it has to do with just the scale of it. But it did used to be a really expensive source of energy, and it's gotten to the point where it's not. Now, at a solar company, that's really tough. Like, you feel like you're constantly struggling just to, you know, make it work. And so for my company, that's challenging. But for the planet, it's great. It's just, it's more economical than any other source of electricity. And so that is a real shift. It's no longer something that we should do, but it's something that just makes sense for everybody. So I would say that's the biggest change, really. Yeah, so I think the real change has been from this kind of push for solar, you know, and just trying to get the word out and have people understand why it's so important. Maybe I'm optimistic, and I am a little bit in a bubble, of course, given my industry, but but I do think a lot more people just get it, and it's really now about getting it out and installed. But it does seem like there's a lot less of explaining the why, but just kind of like the how. How are we going to do this? And that's been a really big change over this short period of time.
It's incredibly exciting. Also, even as a consumer who's been interested in making a big shift, like we have had in the last 6 months, moved to a fully electric car and then obviously had our amazing sun power panels and battery installed. But yeah, how the desire has been there for a really long time. But the accessibility of information on where to get them and as a consumer, how you can even, how many panels you need, what are the different panels, who makes them, what are the supply chains, like all of those things have suddenly become questions you want to ask. But in a really short amount of time, you've learned what you should even be asking. You know, it's just kind of all been gone from, oh, NASA make panels and use them to we can have them in our home. This is what? So out of like kind of very high level, if you had the chance to tell everyone in the world who's like new from a consumer perspective and who isn't in the industry and might not have had, you know, exposure to this, if there's kind of one or two things about solar power that might tip them over the edge or make them more interested if they weren't already, or even some misconceptions you hear all the time that you want to bust as a myth, like what are kind of some of the things you would say as like a gateway drug to solar power?
You know, I think as a consumer, you really can have some more control over your energy usage and your support and where you're getting it from. Talking about the awareness point, when I first started in the industry, I think the fact was that people on average thought about their electricity, you know, 9 minutes a year or something. I mean, it was like unbelievable. People just didn't think about it. You just paid your electricity bill and you just went on with your day. Like there wasn't really any sort of critical thought. And that's changing a lot. And partly like what you explained, people are getting electric cars and they're like, oh, I'm not putting gas in this. I'm putting electricity. Where's my electricity coming from? What's the, you know, so I think people are thinking about it more. They're just engaging with it more. But it does give you a semblance of control. If you're somebody who wants to be supporting renewables, it's a very easy way to do it. And it's often economic too. It's not a luxury to make that choice. It's just economically makes sense. Depending on where you live in the world, there can be some security with it that you can have power when power goes out. You know, so there's some like self-reliance that I think is really attractive to consumers. But, and you kind of vote with your pocketbook, right? As to what you care about. So I think it's empowering not to use the cliche, but it is, you know, you can take some direct control and it provides some security too.
It's been fascinating for us to, even as kind of self-identifying as quite aware consumers, to see how, yeah, getting an electric vehicle, we're like, where do we charge it? And what do we charge it in? And then as soon as you get the panels, it sort of changed all our behaviors around, well, I'll charge the car during the day because it's sunny and I'm on the panels, not the grid, and all that kind of behavioral reflection that you just don't have until you are aware that you can kind of reflect a bit more on that. And that, you know, I would always, our appliances would be used most at night, kind of when you, just by default, you charge your phones and stuff overnight. And then suddenly I was like, wait, during the day with these panels is when I should be doing everything. You just don't think that way until you encourage yourself to do it. So it's been a really interesting behavioral shift. What do you think when consumers might be starting to look at changing to solar power? Obviously on an institutional level, it's different. You're kind of looking at big buildings and machinery and stuff, but in a house, what are the questions that you should start asking? Because it's hard to even know. I didn't even know what panels were made of. I didn't know that sometimes the supply chain in producing the panels is not necessarily a sustainable process, which are kind of in your brain, you're like, wait, that's so many levels of consciousness of planetary implications. Like, but you need to think about that. Like, was it energy efficient to produce the things that you're buying to be more energy efficient?
Yeah. So, I mean, with any product, I think it's a reasonable amount of diligence is a good idea. You know, you're putting it on your roof. But, you know, I think that's also one of the misconceptions too. There's a lot of big money really invested in making solar not succeed still, or other energy alternatives. And that's one of the big talking points, is that the amount of electricity that goes into making a panel offsets the production. And there might be really, really bad products out there where that's true. But, you know, for Maxeon, and, you know, to make a plug for my company, but it's just true, is it, you know, it's less than a year for all the energy it takes, not only to make the panel, but to get it installed. It's like less than a year payback, and we have a 40-year warranty. So it's just like hundredfold electricity. So that is a talking point that can be, you know, countered pretty easily. But I do think as consumers, I would recommend that, you know, you take a look at what you're buying, because it's less obvious than, or, you know, you're just less exposed to it than, let's say, a car, right? Car manufacturers, yeah. You kind of know what kind of car you want. Do I care about, you know, it being electric or luxury, or, you know, you kind of just, and you know the brands and you kind of know the quality. So I would spend the time doing a little bit of research. It's pretty accessible now. So, you know, I don't think it's too difficult, but that's what I would do, is just to make sure you kind of, you know what you're buying.
Yeah. It took us a little while to kind of navigate the names of the players in the industry. And then even the kind of bodies, the official bodies that print reports and what reports you should be looking at. And if you, I mean, I know you probably, coming back to, it's awkward to like give yourself a plug. Yeah. I really want to give SunPower and Maxeon a plug, because we did a lot of research and were so impressed at what a forward-thinking business and how transparent every stage of the manufacturing is, and how many reports there are on kind of the ethical labor standards all the way along the supply chain. And then, you know, internally looking at the sort of volunteering that you can do. International Women's Day is coming up. There's Women at Maxeon Solar. There are so many programs adjacent also to sustainability that made it a really, really cool company that we wanted to just buy panels from, but then continue to be involved in. And the fact that you've worked with NASA, like, that is so cool. So what for you going into this role and then staying for such a long period of time made SunPower different?
First, I wanted to say thank you. That's great. I'm glad that those, you know, the work that we do is from someone who's just as a consumer researching, you're able to find that information. That obviously is meaningful to me, because that's a lot of what we focus on. So thank you for saying that.
I'm like a walking ad. Like, we are in a wonderful partnership together, but that happened after the research. Like, we had already spent like 6 months to a year knowing we were going to renovate a house,
right,
looking for this information. So by the time I'd actually met the team in Australia, they were like, so we've got this report. I was like, oh, I know, I've read it. And they were sort of like, what? You've read it? I'm like, yeah. I'm an informed consumer. I was a lawyer. I read contracts. Like, this is my jam.
Yeah, it just makes me really happy to hear that. Because, you know, I think it would be easy as a solar company to just rest on the fact that you're making solar panels. I mean, that's a pretty big deal, right? Like, your business.
Yeah, that's enough.
That's enough. Like, we've got that covered. You know, like, we're making all of our customers sustainable, so we've got that covered. And, you know, I think that would be easy. But for us, that, you know, we wanted it to take a step deeper and really make sure that the way we're doing that is the best way. And that actually is that's been in the DNA for the company for a long time. You know, we've always been extremely thoughtful about how we manufacture, how do we reduce electricity, how do we reduce water, how do we reduce waste. You know, we're cradle to cradle. Like, there's just a lot above and beyond that we've done. We've got a lot of LEED certified buildings. Because it's manufacturing, and manufacturing is it's a weight on the planet. And so you've got to take a responsibility with that. So we've taken that really seriously. And then, so SunPower is a brand that we use around the world. In the United States, SunPower was a parent company, and then Maxeon was spun out of that into our own separate company for the non-US. So when we spun out Maxeon as our own company, we did take a step back and say, who do we want to be, you know, and how do we address this world market from a value standpoint? In addition to all the environmental, what are the other things that we believe in? And you read about that, like, it sounds like you read our sustainability report, which makes me so happy.
Just some bedtime reading, you know.
But, you know, we think about a lot of the ways that we work, and because that is important. And it's, you know, I think it's really important to our employees, and obviously a lot of our customers, it's important as well. And you really can make a difference with how you do things. So that is fundamental, like I said, in the environmental ways, and then also the other values that we have as a company. The one thing that I did draw me to it, and I'm glad you found us, is your product, to SunPower and Maxeon, is the quality of the products. I mean, the solar panels we make are just top quality. And, you know, the more and more, when you start working in sustainability and you start really thinking about things, you know, I feel like there's like evolutions in the, you know, in sustainability. The first one was, oh my gosh, we're using all this stuff. We've got to figure out how to recycle it, right? So we can use it again. And, you know, I think that came from good intentions, but I think that made people think less about the fact that they're using it to begin with. Cause it was like, oh, if I just recycle it, then I'm doing something good. Where it's like, there's a lot that goes into making that thing to begin with. And then there's a lot that goes into recycling that thing to use it again. And that's better than not recycling it, but is that better than not using it or reducing how much you use, you know? And I think a lot of the recent press around kind of the pitfalls of recycling are starting to make people realize that. But the reason I mention that with our products is they just last a lot longer and you just need less of them. And in the end, that's just reducing your consumption. You know, it makes a difference long term, and it just makes a difference on how many things. Because if you think about like the solar panel on your roof, right? It was made, then it like was transported. Then someone like drove it to your house. They had a bunch of people that drove to your house. They installed it. There was steel, there's electric, you know, there's just a lot that goes into it. And it's going to operate for over 40 years. So it's worth it. But to the extent that happens less, that just has like, you know, kind of a resounding reduction of impact. And I think that's really, you start to, you know, hear a lot about circular economy and just kind of really reducing your impact is a really, really powerful way to be sustainable. And so I'm hoping that it's a complicated message to get out, but I'm really hoping that over time, that's something that, you know, we can really reinforce with our products because they just work for a really long time and work really well. So
even getting told that like our like guarantee, our warranty was 40 years. I was like, mm-hmm. I don't own anything that that guarantees it will be in my life still working at its, mm-hmm. that's not even like it dies in 40 years. That's we can mm-hmm. guarantee its optimum performance in 40 years time. Mm-hmm. I sort of am like, I don't even know what I'm doing in 4 years. Like, but but the panels will be there, yes, doing exactly. the thing for me, which in itself is amazing. And like, so in terms of the product quality and performance, that was immediately a no-brainer before even kind of diving deeper into the supply chain and like the UN development goals that Maxeon and SunPower are signed up to. Are there any other kind of big ticket things that you're really proud of, stats that you're really proud of? Like I know, you know, the recycling of waste is, as you mentioned, sometimes it's better to not be consuming certain things, but the reality of manufacturing is you will be producing a lot of things. Like you guys recycled 68% of your waste last year, I think it was. There's so many amazing certifications and kind of standout points that I've come across in our research. Are there any that you are really, mm-hmm. you know, as the sustainability chief sustainability officer, anything you're particularly proud of that you would want to, if you were doing like a 20-second blind dating with a consumer, what would you tell them?
I am really proud of the fact that we're in the top 50 sustainable companies in the world. And the reason that that's I'm really amazing. Proud of that, I know, right? Because we're not that big.
You know, yeah.
you know, they evaluate 7,000 companies. And, you know, so for me, and like, I feel like we're this little company, like, you know, we're having, you know, outsized recognition. And to me, that speaks volumes to our employees and how much it really, I think it's because it's in the core of everything we do. And it's just, we think through 5 steps ahead and how do we really make an impact? So I'm really, really proud of that because we are, you know, we are one of the smaller solar companies, and getting that recognition, I also think really helps raise the rest of the solar industry. And so, you know, if we can, and we see that right with our competitors, I mean, it makes my job harder because I'm like, oh gosh, they're catching us on all these things. And like, how do we keep, you know, staying ahead? But if I take a step back, I'm like, that's wonderful. Like, the industry is just getting better and more thoughtful and more, you know, more sustainable. So it's really, for me, that's like what I'm really proud of.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see when your competitors are catching up to your like best in practice example. Yeah, it's like annoying, but it's also like, yes, we are leading everyone and dragging them upwards, which is amazing. Yeah. But as we kind of approach International Women's Day, I also know that part of the conversation in the energy sector has been the involvement of women in the sector traditionally, and that maybe not from a consumer basis, but now kind of talking to your position as like a, you know, very, very high level executive in this company, how is diversity and inclusion for employees and increasing women's involvement in sustainable energy, how is that kind of prioritized for you guys? And then what do you see in the industry generally for solar?
Yeah, it's a great question. When I first joined SunPower and got more involved in the solar industry, I was really surprised. I was surprised that it was a topic and something that we needed to work on, because, you know, from outside in, you're like, oh, it's renewables. It's like a, you know, kind of more forward leaning. You kind of feel like that would be, a, you know, you wouldn't have to work on diversity. And so I was kind of taken aback. But, you know, when you peel the layer back, it's an industry of construction and engineering, and those have just historically been male dominated. So it is something that needs to, you know, needs attention and needs to be focused on. And I've certainly over the 13 years seen a change. You know, you do see more women coming in. I think a lot of it's the investment in STEM education and awareness about it generally. Probably also just more of, you know, I think a lot of people are interested in working in clean tech. So, you know, I think there's factors that are all contributing, but it is something that we focus on as a company. And so we do have, when we signed the United Nations Global Compact, we signed on to, you know, the concept is making a better world by 2030. And so we signed on to corporate goals. And one of our corporate goals is to increase female leadership within our company. So we've got a 5-year goal and a 10-year goal. So we are focused on it and driving towards those targets.
That's amazing. And have you found that the industry generally is kind of becoming more aware of getting, you know, women in STEM involved in, especially senior leadership, like actually progressing all the way up, not just like entering the industry?
I think there's awareness. I think progress is slow, you know, because you've got, you know, if you're looking up at like the upper levels of leadership, that takes time. It takes time to, you know, grow and mentor and promote leaders from within, or you can hire them in, you know, but there's a lot of attention that has to be put there. But no, as I mentioned, I think it is, the awareness is certainly there, and you know, there is progress compared to when I joined in 2010, but it is just counterintuitive that an industry like solar would kind of struggle with this. But.
And given that you sort of have started in 2010, gone to 2020, and then looking ahead now, particularly with more of a like a leadership role where you can actually drive kind of the outcomes that we'll be talking about in 2030, what would you love to see? I mean, for a very small company, you guys have so many goal, like looking at the sort of sustainability goals, they cover everything. It's not just supply chain. It's not just partners you'd like to work with. I mean, you're already doing amazing things, not just in space, but like in the Antarctic. Like, I think people think like, oh, I'm a consumer, I'll buy solar panels. But then there's also SunPower Maxeon solar panels like on glaciers. Like it's so cool. By 2030, what would be some things you'd really love to see for you guys and the industry, like the direction you want it to sort of take in the next couple of years?
You know, there's so many cool things happening with solar. You know, I do think, and I don't know if it's by 2030, but I think far in the future, you'll look back and say like a solar panel, like, you know, it's like this thing you just put on a roof. Whereas, you know, a lot of the innovations around incorporation into materials and, you know, the sun's everywhere. The sun's energy is everywhere. It's so abundant and simple that I just love learning about the technology of really kind of more incorporating it into everyday life and the possibilities that you have with that. You know, there's a lot, it's a very small industry right now, but there's a lot of automakers that are looking at how they're building solar cells into the bodies of the cars. Like it's, you know, I think it's going to be fun.
It's cool to see it become like more of a default rather than a whole new brand new thing that's like other to just sort of like, it's in my roof already. Like it's built into my roof. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my roof came with this.
Yeah, or your windows, you know, I mean,
yeah,
cars and roads. And I think it'll become a lot more, you know, ubiquitous in other materials. So that's fun to think about.
Well, Lindsay, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and passion. And it's just amazing to see the things that the company is doing. But to finish up, it would be remiss of me in a podcast about joy not to ask, obviously your job and the industry brings you so much joy, which often makes it hard to make any time for joy outside of that. But I think no one can go full steam ahead at one thing and not kind of have brain time that's relaxing and not related to productivity and work. So when you're playing and just switching off, what are you doing? Which I can imagine is hard because it all involves energy. But how do you switch your brain off and just like enjoy yourself?
If I totally want to switch off and, you know, kind of, I dance.
I love that. What kind of dancing?
Just dancing. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, so it's not very frequent, but you know, for me, that's like a way to kind of escape time and space. And,
you know. I love that.
Yeah, but more frequently, it's things like going on a run or doing some physical activity is probably the general. But
dance is the fun. Dance is the fun answer. And what about your favorite quote? Do you have a favorite motivational quote?
Okay. So I've got two, but they're very short, so don't worry.
No, I will have as many as you've got. They're my favorite.
You've probably heard them before then because they're not that unique. But one, so it's funny that this came up because I, a couple of weeks ago, was going through some really old stuff of mine and, you know, kind of reminiscing a little bit. And I found this journal from when I was in university. I studied abroad a few times and I would travel a lot. And apparently I liked quotes. I don't remember this at all. So I was reading a few of the quotes and there's two that really jumped out at me as motivational. One is that a bumblebee's wings are so thin and their body so big that they shouldn't be able to fly. The only problem is the bumblebee doesn't know that.
I really love
is David Lindsay. He's like an old. And I'll tell you why these two, I think, kind of go together. And then the other one is, you survived 100,000 sperm to get here. What do you mean you don't know what to do?
That's so good.
And I really like them both because I think like the first one is really, I think it's helpful to be a little bit oblivious as to your barriers and like what, you know, I think going back to our, you know, what we're talking about with women and kind of just taking a leap, like, don't overthink it, you know, like it's kind of good if you don't actually know if there's any barriers or if there's any risks and, you know, what people think, like you kind of just a little bit of it's like blind faith. And then I like the 100,000 sperm one too, because it's like it's confidence too. Like, you know what to do, you know, if you're making this decision, you know what to do. So I think it's a little bit of just taking the leap and a little bit of confidence and you'll get there.
I also love that we started with, I've been fascinated by the planet and nature since I was born. And then we finish with a bumblebee and sperm and reproductive system statistics. It all marries up so beautifully.
I guess I'm consistent.
Yeah, what a full circle. Well, Lindsay, thank you so, so much for joining us. This was an absolute delight. And it's such a privilege to be involved with Sunpower and Maxian and to be continuing to share the journey as we sort of get our first power bill in a couple of days and reflect on, you know, the first couple of months and then continue to learn. I think there's so much to learn and share on this electrification journey. And I'm hooked now. Like, I need to calm down on reading reports at night.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. And it's been a real honor for me to be on your podcast. So thank you so much for having me. And I wish you the best of luck in your next journey.
Yay.
It's going to be exciting. So we'll be thinking of you and cheering for you.
What an incredibly inspiring woman. I enjoyed this chat so much. As you guys know, it's not often that we get guests that I haven't spoken to in depth before. And I kind of love that we're all finding out about this new human being and this new pathway all together at the same time. So I hope you guys enjoyed as much as I did. I will pop links to SunPower so you can find out more in all the show notes. Of course, you'll be following along with our journey as well as we learn more about what having solar power involves. We've got an update on our latest energy bill as well coming for you guys on socials. So keep an eye out for that. In the meantime, I hope you are all celebrating each other, celebrating the incredible women around you and in your lives. Again, happy International Women's Day. I hope you're seizing your yay this week, and we will be back next week with more.